Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's a Tuesday edition of Zero Block 30, and today we have six rounds in the magazine. Round number one, Magawa, our friend who happens to be a rat from Tanzania, is finally given an award for his heroics. You're not going to believe what this African giant poached rat has accomplished. It really is breathtaking. Round number two, it's an ammunition backpack, Michael. What could it weigh? 20 pounds? The Navy is rolling out a backpack that can carry a molly whopping 650 rounds of 7.62 ammo. Wowzers. We're going to get into that backpack that would make you look like a big man baby. Round number three. Another man baby admits that he goes to the doctor all the time. He's what we in the military would call a sick call warrior. It's time to make fun of a weenie. Sorry, Kate. Round number four, the Marine Corps is considering shutting down both of its recruit depots so that it can open up a co-ed one. Shh. If you listen closely, you can hear the angry goateed and bearded veterans grabbing their keys in order to film an angry rant in their trucks. Round number five, Kate interviews Chris Marvin, who's a former helicopter pilot. He's going to bring you on. He's going to come on and talk about why 22 push-ups doesn't actually help, the role of guns in veteran suicide, Veterans for Gun Sense in 2020. With it being National Suicide Awareness Month, we wanted to bring somebody on who is diving deep into that subject. And there's been a lot of reporting going on that I saw this weekend that military veterans and active duty members suicide has actually gone up 20% with COVID going on too. It's really, really a big thing that we have to focus on and do something different. Push-ups, t-shirts, not sure any of that shit helps. We have to do better for each other. Round number six is going to be, there's a certain people who have a lifetime of stories that you love to listen to while drinking a hot tea and sugar cookies. Lillian Brown is one of those people. She was a makeup artist for 9 U.S. presidents. The things that she must have heard over the course of her career has got to be astounding. She probably catapults way up our list that we did a couple months ago where we talked about who would we want to eat dinner with. I might bring old Lillian. I mean, yeah. Firsthand account to 9 presidents. And not only that, she also did the makeup for like Martin Luther King, Eleanor Roosevelt, all kinds of people. The list that she was with is insane. It's a who's who of American history.
I'm just thinking of the skill of this woman, too. A lot of old white men with liver spots. Yes. That's a lot to cover up. That's no easy feat.
Well, my favorite one comes from longtime stoolie Richard Nixon. You're going to hear about that story when we get to the round. Mm-hmm. And all that today is going to be brought to you by our good friends at BarkBox. Look, I saw this picture. It wasn't even on like from the ads or anything like that. I saw this picture this weekend of this dog. It was a husky. It was one of those freaky huskies too, because you know, huskies, I think huskies are creepy looking dogs.
They look into your
their
soul.
Eyes. Yeah, their yeah, eyes.
The,
yeah.
The two different color eyes always. No disrespect to people like Max Scherzer, who has the same thing. But the two different color eyes really throws me off. I saw a picture of a husky standing in a park. It was a beautiful park. There's people socially distanced throughout, laying on their little towels and what have you. And the husky had, you know those, they were popular for a while, the growlers, like going to a beer store and getting a growler
getting
filled
beer,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a dog toy that looks like a growler. And I just think it's like the cutest thing in the world. This dog is, the dog's just showing up. He's like, hey, motherfuckers, I'm here to party. I opened up my ad reads this morning, and that's one of the things that they have. It's from BarkBox is where that thing's from. And you can get it for cheaper if you go to BarkBox.com/ZBT. You get a free extra toy in every box. That's a $60 value when you sign up. That's BarkBox.com/ZBT for free extra toy in every single box. And they're all cool. Whether it's the acorn, the steak, the grill, the weed, whatever. BarkBox is changing the game of dog toys. It's not just fucking little old ducks anymore. It's all kinds of stuff. Get your ducks in a row and go to BarkBox.com/ZBT. Kate liked that one. Let's get started with the show.
Dude,
huge announcement. Today, the high here in San Antonio, 75 degrees.
Oh, delightful.
The high. Now,
it's warmer here.
I cannot wait to go out. After we're done recording, I wanted to get recording done soon because I'm just going to take my laptop outside, kick my feet back on the porch, and just do some old school blogging from there. I love that weather. I think when you wake up and it's a football Saturday and you have a crispness in the air of, I'd say 61 when you wake up with a high of 74, 75, to me, that's the perfect day.
It's perfect. Ideal. It's
anytime, anytime I can put a vest on without sweating and we're cooking.
Or oh, you're one of those vest ladies. Short sleeve hoodies.
Yes. Also prime for football weather.
Absolutely. The old Bill Belichick style, but without the holes.
And we need to address the elephant in the room. Our Catherine has bangs.
Yes, I do. I cut them myself in the bathroom with kitchen scissors last night.
Yeah.
On a whim. I've been going through a lot of moments where I think every lady does every few months, you're like, I should cut bangs. It's just this evil little voice that pops in your head and you shouldn't listen to it. But last night I did. The Eagles took another real, I don't know. I blame the Eagles for this one. I was sitting on the couch. It was a weird Sunday. I was like, you know what? I'm doing it. I'm cutting bangs. I went to a YouTube tutorial that told me though, easy old girl, don't just grab a bundle and go to town. Easy snips, and I don't hate it, I have to tell you.
So, yeah, it looks good.
So I think at some point in every girl's life, their mother cut their hair, and usually it's the point in their life where they look back and say, that was terrible. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think of when people cut their hair at home, specifically females. But with you did it. You posted a picture last night. It looked amazing. And I was saying before we started recording, we didn't get a frantic, guys, I paid $500,000 for a haircut and I hate it. So that was good. That was
part
positive.
Of that's that I have just given up. I just don't care anymore. I'm done. Put a fork in me. But yeah, so there you go. Good for you.
Looks lovely. Looks awesome. Other than that, not a whole lot going on in my neck of the woods. We have a lot of stuff to talk about today, so we're just going to hop straight into the topics. The first comes from Cambodia. It's not often that we have a Cambodia story on our list of topics to go through. Kate, walk us through a little bit of what's going on in round number one.
Let me start out with a highly intelligent and idealistic young rat with unusually acute sense and taste of smell who dreams of becoming a chef like his idol, Auguste Gusteau. However, the rest of his colony, including his brother Emile and his father Django, are interested in food only for sustenance, can you imagine? But one day, Remy and Emile go retrieve seasoning for some of Remy's food, only to have an encounter with the homeowner. The elderly homeowner accidentally damages her home ceiling while trying to kill Remy and Emile with a shotgun, which forces the entire colony to flee. Remy is separated from the clan and eventually finds himself above the kitchen of Gusteau's restaurant in Paris.
No, wait. That's actually the plot of Ratatouille. That's a different story. Altogether. This one's from Cambodia, actually. And this one is about a hero rat. His name is Magawa, who is an African giant poach rat who was trained to sniff out landmines and unexploded ordnance in Cambodia. And Magawa is damn good at what he did, too. Over the past 4 years, the brass bald little fella has sniffed out 39 landmines and 28 unexploded munitions. His bravery earned him a gold medal from a British veterinarian charity on Friday. Magawa's work directly saves and changes the lives of men, women, and children who are impacted by these landmines. Every discovery he makes reduces the risk of injury for death or the death of local people. This rat, Magawa, was born in Tanzania in November of 2014, so he's only 6 years old. He accomplishes a lot more than I did by the time I was six. Magawa was immediately trained in the art of smelling explosives. Trainer used a clicker to teach rats how to scratch at the ground and above a landmine. We called that in the biz. Imprinting is what that's called. And you can basically do it for any animal that has heightened sense of smell. Like if you take a dog, for example, this is how we do it with dogs. So we have this long wall that will have several different holes in different areas, ranging from right on the ground up to about 6 feet tall and usually in the shape of a V. You put some explosives in there, and as soon as, or drugs or whatever you want the dog to find, as soon as the dog puts his nose in there and you can see him sniff a lot, you drop a toy over the top of their head. And so then they start to associate through conditioning that smell equals toy. The same thing is going on with the rat, because they go on to explain that when the rat comes across the explosive, they put the clicker on, and then as soon as the clicker comes, then they have a little bit of food that they toss, and the rat gets a reward. None of these animals know that they're looking for bombs or anything like that. They just think that they're looking for treats, and you can always have, they're always hungry for treats, so they want to go out and buy treats. This is exactly what happened with Magawa, but Magawa did it a little bit different. He started training, and 9 months he completed it and was sent to Cambodia. Imagine being 9 months old, because he would started training as soon as he was born. 9 months old, and you got to go up to your mom rat and be like, "Mom, they're shipping me out. Got to go to Cambodia.
Got to find them landmines.
Those little mines."
He's just so cute and tiny, and he did a great job. They said that he found, this is how many he found. When he got there, he would go for 30 minutes at a time and clear the size of a tennis court. Now, they say on here that that would take a person with a metal detector 4 days. There is no shot.
And a lot of puckered asshole.
Right. That is true, yeah, for sure. But Cambodia, this needed to happen in Cambodia, because a lot of people don't realize that there were 4 to 6 million landmines laid between 1975 and 1998. Jeez. Kate and I actually talked a little bit about it on the Chaps and Kate show on Friday. Kate, do you remember why they said they did this?
Yeah, so they were Chinese-made landmines, and they were placed during, it was years and years of civil war, and the 1970s, the 1980s, and into the 1990s. But a lot of the times, you would think, oh, they're placing them to kill the enemy. A lot of times, because the civil war was going on for so long, they started placing them around, like, really significant cultural and spiritual areas to protect those areas from being looted. Mm-hmm. So now the most key parts of so many villages and areas in Cambodia are just covered with these mines. So it's left, I think there's over, if I'm reading this correctly, there's over 40,000 amputees in that country because of this. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just horrible. So common for people to get killed or mutilated by these things. So they're absolutely everywhere. So they need programs like that. And there's all sorts of charities and organizations trying to get them out, all the mines out. But when there's 4 to 6 million, I mean, you've got, so hopefully they're training more and more rats. If he could do that many, it would be a great asset for every village to have a rat. That'd be pretty sweet.
You would think, like, oh, they're using a rat because, you know, I'm sure the rat has a great sense of smell. But also, too, like, if the rat gets blown up, no one's going to really care.
No, but now you've seen Magawa cons.
Now, let me finish, chaps.
Okay.
But when you see the picture of Magawa and you see the picture of these rats, and I saw some pictures of them with these little harnesses on leashes, and you realize they're these cute guys. And when you think about it, they've trained with
or humans, lady rats.
Or lady rats,
thank
excuse
you.
Me. they totally threw me off there, but they develop a relationship with their trainers, so yeah, they have feelings just like they would any other animal. So let's not just dismiss these rats so quickly, because they are very effective.
My cousin had a rat, rest in peace to Cheddar, but it would like go in her mouth.
And Jetty boy,
and wait, rest what? In peace.
It would go where, Kate? It would go where?
In her mouth, and like they bond by like cleaning their owner's teeth and stuff.
Yeah,
like
that's still
but
not cool.
People who have rats are like super tight with them.
That's how you get the fucking plague. You don't do that. That's gross.
But she's okay.
But people are starting to see there's this Instagram account that says, I think it's called Cows or Dogs or something like that, where people that have, if there is a cow that was not accepted by its mother, then the people become essentially like the mom, and the cows act like dogs, essentially. Like, they rest up against the owner. They'll lay with them in the field. They'll do all kinds of stuff. There's recently been a Netflix documentary about an octopus and how it completely changed the guy's life because the octopus knew that it could get killed or something like that. Like, I can't watch it because he said it. The title says it's sad, not going to watch it. But people are starting to see that these animals have feelings. And I can totally see you get, if you're this rat's handler and you've been his handler for 9 months and you go with him, watching him go through these tennis ball or tennis court size areas looking for landmines, you'd be so nervous, man. Yeah. I was like that with Saika. If there's ever times that I would send Saika off leash to go look for an area, you can't control what they're doing. And if they're getting a little wild, especially with all those new smells in like a foreign land and like going to check things out, you never knew what was going to happen. You would be sitting there watching with bated breath. I imagine that's how that handler feels. And I also imagine that he must have so much pride. That little article that the New York Times posted when he's standing there and McGow was like high-breasted and he's got his medal around his neck. He's got to be so proud.
I'll tell you
he
what.
He has a button.
If we don't get a Pixar movie about McGow in the next 5 years, we're doing something wrong here.
Yeah, I think it should be I don't know. I think it should be real life. Could they do that? I bet they could do that now.
If they
could
live action for sure.
Yeah, it's got to
be a
live
little
action.
Bit of a buzzkill. Hopefully not. some point.
Hopefully not. But I just wanted to mention him because that's pretty damn impressive. The things that he did, the fact that he cleared over 26 American football field size areas so that kids can go play without losing their limbs. We're joking about it, but it is an awesome story and just the innovative approach of how to get these out of here, because it landmines, like Kate was saying, are kind of like drinking on 4th of July and popping off too many fireworks, where you think it's a great idea and then you walk outside and you remember the next morning you got to pick them all up. You're like, oh shit, there's stuff everywhere. I don't want to pick these things up. Picking up landmines, actually dangerous.
It's not pretty great. Bad, not fun. No.
Not fun at all. What would be fun would be firing off what we have in round number two. Kate, walk us through that.
Round number two, expeditionary warfare engineers from the Naval Surface Warfare Center Crane Division.
Crane Division.
I think that's after Karate Kid.
Actually. Yes. I think it is. I think it does. Or paper cranes. They could be big origami guys.
People have often said that the Navy is the Cobra Kai of the military.
It's true. Waxing off rust on those ships is what they do. Anyways, the Crane Division has developed an ammunition backpack for belt-fed machine guns. Innovative businesses can license the invention for the development of new products. This technology is TRL-9, named after...
Carson Daly.
Carson Daly, yes. TRL-9. It also plays music, I think. Multiple units have been built, fielded, and used in combat already. So as soon as I read that, I'm thinking... Well, a backpack for belt-fed weapon, we were talking about military terms the other day, and the whole nine yards is when you use the whole nine yards of belt-fed ammo super quick, and that's like, oh, shit, we just went the whole nine yards. Shit's getting real. It goes fast. In the heat of the moment, belt-fed ammo goes pretty damn quick, so I'm thinking, well, how much could a backpack possibly carry for you? Well, here's where it gets interesting. A lot. An absolute shit ton of it. Apparently, current backpack ammunition systems have undesirable attributes. For example, they are super heavy in their own. They're made out of steel or aluminum. They weigh at least 16 pounds. About 500 rounds can be held, and they're expensive. They cost like $4,000. This alternative ammo dispensing backpack weighs less. It's only 9 pounds. It can hold a 650-round belt of NATO 7.62. Costs only $300, simpler to construct, and it so you can hold a lot more, a lot lighter, and you can actually go the whole nine yards a little bit easier with this sucker on. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it holds 650 rounds, and I went and did the math on this. Each round, each 7.62 round weighs 25.4 grams. So that's how many grams total, Kate?
16,510 grams.
Nailed it, grams. Wow. Which equals
my 30. Brain wanted to say 16,510.
So that equals 36 pounds. So if you have 36 pounds plus the 9 pounds, so you got 45 pounds total. 45 pounds total to have 650 rounds. That's not bad. That's pretty damn good.
That is really good. And there's probably people listening who are like, oh, 45 pounds, you're such a pansy, chaps. Go put 45 pounds on your back and walk around for 3 to 6 hours and see how light that 45 pounds
feels. Doesn't anyone remember the backpack powered Super Soaker? Did you not have to wear it as a kid?
Super Soaker 3000 is what it was called.
It was to put the backpack with the two tubes of water on it. And you're trying to run around the yard.
You had to pump it for like 8 days.
That's pretty much what it's like to a T. I mean, I'm not infantry, but I'd say safe to say.
It's probably pretty damn close. 2 gallons of water on your back. That each gallon of water weighs 6 pounds. So it's pretty damn close to what you would have on there.
Yeah, it was exactly, and it's all relative too, because back then you're 8 to 10 years old, that's a lot heavier.
Yeah,
that's what it's like.
But what else do you, I mean, that's only the ammo. If you're out there and you have to stay out of like wire for a while, you also have all kinds of other shit. So it is pretty heavy. But if you're walking through, just the psychological deterrent of seeing somebody walk in with that bad boy on, that's intimidating as shit if you have that on your back. But yeah, also, you're not running very fast.
On a couple of our patrols, we had a guy who would bring the 240 out. It would be across his back and the other guys would be carrying the other stuff. But I'm like, I don't know if that's a deterrent or if the enemy is like, look how slow they're about to go.
That's stupid. Like, probably, heavy.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They're definitely not fun to carry around. But this is as close as we would get, I think, to the Hollywood where you see people with the belt fed ammo across their chest and they just come in and they look very intimidating. I think this is as close as we could get to a real world simulation of that.
And Rambo never talked about that you have to shave your chest in order to do that.
Right.
Belts will absolutely rip your chair straight out of your body.
Imagine how uncomfortable that part of it would be.
Walking up and down, like going up in hills and rocky terrain, those little belt like clips pinching your skin.
I mean, just ripping hairs out one by one.
One happens to get across a hold of your areola.
Forget it. Not to mention the smell then of burnt hair as it's firing would get everybody else sick. Yeah. Be real. It's a whole debacle. People don't think about it.
It would be a complete debacle. I love the idea of having 650 rounds, though. Like, if you have that and you have, like, just that dumb kid, like I talked about PFC Taylor, who used to be one of my Marines, just an absolute idiot. If you tell PFC Taylor, go grab the 650 round backpack, he's going to walk with that thing all day, not care. He's not even going to know it's on because he's so stupid.
Best Marines out there.
And the best Marines are the ones you can tell the weight that's just absolutely the wrong number and is significantly lower just to psychologically psych them up and keep them going.
How much does weigh stuff aren't? Oh, that's only like 12 pounds, dude. You got to I'll carry this all day.
That would work on me for sure because then I beat myself up all afternoon. I'd be like, come on, you little bitch. What's wrong with you?
God, I'm such a pussy. Absolutely. I'm telling you, that would definitely work.
Yeah, good leadership for sure.
All right, let's move on to round
number
3.
Good leadership point right there. Just lie. Just lie to your troops and Marines.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really a good leadership lesson just to lie all the time. You really got to do it. Let's move on to round number 3, which is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Feltman's. Feltman's is a great hot dog company. If you haven't tried their stuff yet, you need to try it out. Feltman's of Colonia is the world's first hot dog brand that was established in 1867, with Charles Feltman being the inventor of the Glizzly. The Glizzly, the hot dog.
The Glizzy.
That's what they used to call it.
Yeah.
Well, that's
the original name, the Glizzy.
I had no idea.
That's what all the kids are calling them these days now. I want a Glizzy. So.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. It's all 100%. Over Barstool.
I blame Drake. Feltman's, it's also a military veteran-run business that was revived in 2015. The founders, Michael and Joe Quinn, revived the brand in honor of their late brother Jimmy, who was tragically killed in 9/11. And when I say veteran-owned, these are hardcore veterans with 30 years in uniform and 113 months deployed overseas. Feltman's hot dogs are delicious. So is their mustard. We talked about that a bunch on this show. Go to Feltman's at Coney Island on their Instagram profile, Feltman's at Coney Island, and click the link in their bio. Enter your email. And if you follow them on Instagram and Twitter, they will post about it. So if you want to increase your chances, follow them on Instagram and Twitter and tag your friends in those posts. They're going to do a giveaway for free hot dogs for life. That's why you have to enter.
And you want these weenies. Life. I'm telling you. Yes, you do. I've been living off them. They're a goddamn delight.
If you're wanting hot dogs for life, that's a lot of hot dogs. I don't know how they're going to – what? Imagine Frank the Tank wins.
Oh,
Frank the Tank wins this thing. He's crushing four dogs on a Friday. That's going to be adding up. They might go out of business.
They are legit delicious hot dogs, though. They're like the best I've had. So they're really fucking good.
So if you want to enter that contest to win free hot dogs for life, go to Feltman's of Coney Island or Feltman's Coney for their Instagram profile, and you can enter to win that to get free hot dogs for life. Incredible.
Free hot dogs for life. Awesome. Pretty much, though, you give me anything for life, and I'm making the best of it, and it's going to be a good deal.
Bold.
Except maybe like a deadly disease.
God likes free stuff for the rest of his life.
Hell yeah.
All right, let's move on to round number 3. This story doesn't have a whole lot of military aspects, but I saw it yesterday afternoon, and I thought, Ray, why in the fuck would you write this article, Ray? Why would you go onto your main local newspaper, Why would you write it? There's just absolutely no reason for Ray Kisnosis, I think that's how you say his name, to write this letter. But he penned this himself. It's a little bit of an op-ed, and it blew my mind.
What newspaper? What newspaper was it?
Let me see. It was, damn it, Kate.
Sorry.
It was super just to local set the tone, because I was so excited.
It's an op-ed.
It's a tiny little Maine newspaper. I can find it real quick.
So a little op-ed by Ray in the Maine newspaper.
So Evening News is where it's from. Ah. That's S-O-O from Salt News. It's Salt from Salt Marie, Maine?
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah.
All right, just setting the tone. It's a little local story. Okay.
Yeah, a little local story, and it's lovely. I'm going to go ahead and read this one. This is him. This is Ray. Ray penned this himself. And to give you an idea, Ray, if you've never been to – have you guys ever been to Rent-A-Center?
Yes, unfortunately.
Yes. Ray looks like he looks like one of the people that when you walk into a Rent-A-Center and he asks you if you need any help. Right?
Like, and you say yes. And 100%. You say yes, you do, even if you don't, because you can tell Ray needs
Ray wants
really
he
needs
friendly,
you to rent a TV today.
But he Ray's wearing a black long sleeve dress shirt with a black and gray tie. He's got his black and gray goatee, some Walgreens glasses on, but his hair looks lovely for his age. He's got a forehead of lettuce.
Yeah,
shout out to Ray for that, but I'm not gonna give him any more shout outs, so I had to say something nice. You got to sprinkle in a compliment with all the shit talking you're gonna do. Here we go. He said, I had a sore thumb, but it didn't really stick out, and I went to urgent care. Men have a reputation to avoid physicians. Many could accidentally slice off an appendage while working on a power saw, rub some dirt on it, and then continue building a house. Some will boast about not visiting a doctor's office for years. Not me. I'll go ahead of an illness. In recent years, I have been fighting recurring sinus infections due to allergies. When I started getting a headache the other day, I made an appointment for the upcoming week, anticipating the worst. I actually made an appointment with a doctor thinking I was going to get sick. Is it because I'm a sissy? Maybe. But I think it's more of an intolerance to pain or a fear of death. So when I had a weird ache in my thumb that wouldn't go away, I said to heck with it and sought immediate professional help. I am certain I get this kind of attitude from my mother. She is a bit of a hypochondriac, and us kids were unable to offer any of the sympathetic ear she required because we all had heard it before year after year. A physician, on the other hand, could listen to her strange symptoms, rub her back, and happily charge her GM insurance. After a while, my mom visited her doctor so often that she would bring him a coil of kielbasa or homemade bread or canned beets as a payment for her copay, and the doctor would gladly accept knowing she was well insured. I admit I am perhaps a bit of a hypochondriac too, but I am also aware that as a man, I am supposed to take the pain, which is dumb. I agree with that. There is a lot of fragile masculinity that goes into not going to the doctor when you need to. I think I broke my toe yesterday, by the way. I might have to go to the doctor.
Well, my dad will tell me something like, you know, I didn't want to worry you, but I've been having a little trouble with XYZ. So I have an appointment coming up. That's kind of a big deal. I'm like, well, how long have you been feeling this way? And he's like, about 3.5 years now. And I'm like, what the fuck's wrong with you? What the fuck? That's a big deal.
Oh, okay. You are one to that. That is pot kettle big time.
Yeah.
Big it's true. Time. It did take me like 5 years to go to a dentist and 8 to go to a doctor. But
like, oh,
that's okay.
I'm hurt. I have a sore tooth. If only there was a specialized treatment that I could go to that was covered by my insurance that I already
anyways
he said. He goes on to say, after all, I'm not a military man. I've seen, and that's the line right there that allows us to go into this topic. He said, I've seen all the movies and heard all the stories from friends who served and the painful things they had to endure, like blisters and things. Yeah, that's the worst part. The blisters. My own son caught pneumonia while in basic training. He took one day off and rejoined his platoon because he was afraid of not completing his requirements on time and being forced to repeat. Pneumonia? Are you kidding? I would have been on my back for a month insisting to Dr. Drill Sergeant or Mr. Drill Sergeant that I was simply too sick to complete anything except for bed rest. That's one reason I never joined the military.
At least he knew.
The second was because he called him Mr. Drill Sergeant.
At least he knew not to join, though, because some people like this do join, and he did not. Okay.
Can you just imagine, though? Excuse me, Mr. Drill Sergeant, I have a boo-boo.
Still, I don't like to go to the doctor for every paper cut I endure while on the job, but this thumb problem I had simply would not go away. It was hard to put even on. It was hard to even put on pants. I tried bandages and ointments, but nothing worked. So finally, I went, and I'm glad I did. The doctor said it was an infection, and untreated, it would have spread to my blood and poisoned my entire body, and could have also led to death. So it made me feel a lot better know that I wasn't overreacting, because I've certainly overacted before, like the time I had a gas bubble and thought I was having a heart attack.
I love this guy.
I knew you were going to. That's why I said sorry, Kate, in the rounds. He said, I think I stuck out a little bit in the ER like a sore thumb. There is times where this type of thing happens. And you know, Ray, and he went back to his wife and was like, honey, they said I could have died. I'm not a big old bitch, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How much you want to bet, though? Because the doctor's just so fed up with Ray at this point. He's like, yeah, Ray, thank God you came in. You could have died, knowing full well that it was nothing at all.
Oh, I like Ray. He's admitting the way a lot of people are.
I knew you were going to like Ray. I just absolutely knew it. But it got me thinking yesterday, there is certain times that I should have gone to the doctor when I didn't. And there's times also that I went to the doctor when I probably shouldn't have. And I think that we talked about that a bunch before, but we're going to do it again. So I wanted to ask you guys, Kate, do you have one time that you didn't go to the doctor and you probably should? Besides your entire life,
the first thing that came to mind was the first of many times when I was super young and stupid that I had alcohol poisoning. Yeah. I was in 11th grade. I weighed maybe 115 tops, but I was still my height. I was like 5'9", 115. I was like a walking Skeletor.
Gangly.
And we went to this party in another school district. It was a New Year's Eve party. And I ended up beer bonging 151.
Oh, that sounds smart.
And I had never really drank before,
well,
so I didn't know.
Well, that's not fair, because when you're a young whippersnapper, you have no idea that 151 means 151 proof. And even if you did, you don't know what that means.
At the time, it would have meant nothing to me, because I was like super protected from alcohol, like all that stuff. I was never allowed to like have the sip of wine. It did. Like, I had no idea what any of that meant. And so I beer bonged it, and then it was like crushing a bunch of beers. I did all this within probably 20 minutes. And then my friends were trying to
The idea of just drinking 151 makes me puke. Yeah.
But then I vaguely remember my friends doing whatever they could to like just not let adults find out. Like I could have probably died the way that it was handled that night. And then the next day, my dad picking me up from my friend's house and me being like, food poisoning from the diner real bad. And just silent, like him having to roll down the window so I could puke out the van on the way home. I was sick for like 4 days. I was
not realizing that, because you're not an experienced drinker, that he could smell the booze. And it's definitely not bad chicken salad.
Yeah.
I remember my uncle, one time we got in the car. He's like, oh, you guys been drinking? And we're like, no. He's like, guys, let me just tell you something for life. As soon as you have one beer, you can smell it. So just quit the lying right now.
Yeah, idiot move, but I definitely, for sure, in hindsight, if I was a parent and that was my kid, I would have been like, oh my God, I cannot believe my child was not in the ER getting her stomach pumped last night. Mm-hmm. But the good thing was we didn't get in trouble. We didn't get caught.
Now, was there a time that you did go that you probably shouldn't have?
probably at MP school. They had this giant swimming pool on Fort Leonard Wood. And I loved, this is the stupidest thing, on the weekends, like some people go to swim and train. I loved doing cannonballs off the high dive. I loved going
and this
there.
This is as a grown person.
This is as a grown, I was like 23 or something. I loved jumping off and doing like can openers and stuff off the giant high dive.
Cat knife.
Yeah, woo, gotcha. And so I was there with a couple buddies and I'm going to do a pencil. And so I did a pencil and I went down really fast all the way to the bottom, but it was like a military pool, it was super deep. And immediately I felt this crack sensation in my head. And I was so disoriented. I could barely find the surface of the water. I couldn't see straight. I had to go over the side. It turns out I had cracked my eardrum, but there's nothing you can do. It's one of those injuries. It hurts. You just wait it out. There's nothing to do. Mm. But I was such a baby about it. They had to call my staff sergeant, who was like a total hard ass. And he had to, it was like a Sunday morning or something like that. And he had to leave his family and come pick me up personally to take me to the hospital. And he was like, what happened? What did you do? And I was like, I did a pencil dive.
This swimming pool was doing a jackknife.
Yeah, he was furious. And like there was nothing they could do. So they were like, thanks for coming to the hot. Like, it was just stupid.
And then when you walk back out to the waiting room, be like, they just told me to wait a couple of days and I'll be fine.
Yeah, and he had to wait with me, like,
so embarrassed.
He had to wait with me like all day. It was awful, and I just shouldn't have gone. And I regret that. But sorry, those are my two alcohol poisoning.
And that's the reason why you became a nose plugger whenever you dive in the pool.
That is why I do.
Like a freaking weirdo loser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she doesn't want to have to call her staff sergeant again. Let her know.
Top tier swim calls. So get off my dick.
There, whoa. Cons, what about you? Any times that you should have gone, didn't?
Yeah, absolutely. Every time I had a concussion in high school, I had multiple concussions in high school. Yeah. And our team doctor, I don't know, I don't even remember. I think he just looked at me and said, like, oh, yeah, you're good to go, whatever. Knowing now what I know about concussions, that was totally not the right move to do. Mm-hmm. And then to go back into the games, I never sat out of the game every time I got a concussion. And then finally, when I got a concussion in college and I saw how you were supposed to treat a concussion, I realized, wow, I that probably should have done that the four times I had a concussion in high school.
You were like that kid in the whipped cream titty movie, Varsity Blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. Okay.
The whipped cream titty movie.
The big guy who's like, if he gets hit
no,
one
we
more
knew
time.
Exactly what she was talking about. And she, I knew Brie Lauder right away. Yeah, or Allie Lauder.
Allie Lauder. Yeah, no, you definitely should have gotten a CAT scan. Absolutely. Got my CAT scan. Now I can play. But then the one time in high school I was given blood, I don't get queasy about anything, but I definitely milked it. And I was like, I got to go see the nurse. I just didn't feel like going back to class. And I knew they'd give me donuts and juice if I just like completely just said I was going to pass out. And I totally milked it for at least an hour and a half. Usually they say like you should rest for, I don't know, like 15 minutes after you give blood. I was able to stay there in that lounge chair for an hour and a half.
That's nice. What about you did go and shouldn't have?
Yeah, no. Well, that was the one. I was like, I need to see the nurse after giving blood. And then she's like, okay, you just need to sit down longer. And I
If they're giving cookies out, you got to stay and there donuts. As long as you can. Get as many cookies as you possibly can.
Yeah,
mine, where I should have went to the doctor, I was riding on my friend Lauren Birch's Honda Accord whenever we were in high school. Mm-hmm. And it was a brand new Honda Accord, by the way. And I was on the front of the hood. And it was a mistake because she had just started driving, essentially. I didn't know, like, gas, brake, and really how to drive smoothly. Well, she essentially kind of gunned it, but not intentionally. And I flew off the side of the car and it was only my big toe got ran over. Just my big toe. How it happened, it could do a million times again and it would never happen that way. But it ripped all the skin from like my big toe knuckle all the way across, ripped my toenail off. And at this time, my parents, my mom and stepdad had moved back to Jacksonville. I was living with the Cajuns and Pensacola still. I still had health insurance, but I called my mom and let her know what happened. I legit took like super glue and glued my toe, like the skin of it back on, like with new skin that you see I would use in tennis too for bad blisters, mm-hmm. and glued it back on. I probably should have went to the doctor.
Essentially what the doctor would have done anyway. So, you know, no.
Yeah, my mom
really
was furious about this. She's probably going to call me after listening because she listens every week. She's going to call me and be like, you were so stupid back then.
I just wasn't ready to think about your toe knuckles yet this morning. I needed a little more time.
Yeah,
toe knuckles is such a gross term. Toe knuckles.
It is a gross one. I apologize.
Toe knuckle.
Not only to you, but to the listener as well.
Thank you.
And times that I did go that I shouldn't is every time that I thought I used to pray that I would tear a ligament in my knee or in my elbow or something like that. I just wanted a vicious, unrelenting injury, sports related, whenever I was growing up. And if I twisted my knee or something like that and it was super swollen, and my mom would be like, oh, you probably don't need to go to the doctor. And I would cry like a little bitch about it. And then we'd end up going to the doctor. I wish that I could go back and just have a torn ligament. But when they come back and just say it's a sprain and you need to wear an ACE bandage, the ACE bandage, I think essentially was just to keep my morale up.
Yeah.
They're like, we can't make this kid walk out of here with nothing. We got to throw him some ACE bandages his way and just let him get on his way. The military doctor, I haven't thought about this in forever. I got stung by a bumblebee. So, and that's That just makes me sound like Ray from the previous, or the, from this round. So you're saying bumblebee because in Maryland, they have these little white flowers that grow up out of the grass that are, and bumblebees are everywhere. And you can't take the Florida out of the kids. So I would go everywhere barefoot. And I got stung, I think it was 4 times in a week on the same foot by a bumblebee. And by the time I was done, my body was like, enough with the bumblebees. My leg was so swollen that they put an ACE bandage around my foot for bumblebee stings because I had been stung by so many bumblebees.
They didn't know what else to do with you.
Yeah, because I was kind of a little pussy, honestly. Like, I was a pretty rough and tumble kid, but looking back after saying that, I have the realization I was definitely a pussy kid.
I definitely went a bunch of times when I probably didn't have, when I was younger. Well, no, there was always a break or like a ligament tear. Like there was usually something wrong, but I was such a baby about, like, I was such a, like, so dramatic. And in college, I got slammed by this girl. We were in the championships for rugby and we were out in Bowling Green and I got slammed. You know how you're not supposed to reach up and catch the ball when it's coming at you in football? I did that and got trucked by this like 300-pound girl going full speed. And for days afterwards, I was like, and it took me a while. And then everything kind of felt wrong. And then the one day I'm at the like cafeteria with my girlfriends eating and I like twist a certain way. And I was like, my face drooped a little bit. I was like, oh my God, I'm in so much pain right now. It turns out I had broken my back in 2 places. And I was running around for like 2 months with a broken back, just zero idea, just partying it up, still doing keg stands and shit like that.
Kyle did the same thing. That's why he eventually got retired from the Marine Corps, right, Kyle?
Yeah, I herniated my L5-S1 and thought I pulled a muscle for a year because I'm a fucking idiot. And I was running and doing the whole Marine thing for a year and then my legs started going numb and
that'll happen.
A muscle.
Kate, I will say though, I appreciate you say like, oh, you're not supposed to put your arms up and try to catch the ball. You will if you're willing to sell out for your team.
See, you weren't even thinking about what Kyle said there, Cons. You just went back to football. Like, what a fucking jock move. Kyle's explaining why he got retired from the Marine Corps.
Doesn't want me to harm
and you're like,
him.
Oh, I don't Kyle want everybody want to forget harm. I too played football.
I we love get it when Cons myself. Talks about football. Everyone loves it.
So what did they do, Kyle? Listeners. Like, whenever you went in and you got checked out, did they give you treatment that helped it?
No, not really. I got an MRI. They found it was herniated and then they put me in physical therapy, which, I mean, what the fuck do you do for a herniated disc? Then they operated on it and then that didn't work. So that was when I,
but there is, even though I know it was disappointing for you because you were very proud Marine and you wanted to do 20, like usually if you reenlist once you're really thinking about doing it a career, there had to be something when you walk into your first sergeant with your chit. And you're like, oh no, I'm actually fucked up. Where you're just not like malingering, and it still goes through your head no matter what rank you attain.
I mean, it's not like I had a cast on or anything. It was pretty invisible to everybody else, and I was still crushing it with the CFT and PFT and stuff. It just really fucking hurt. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
you hear that? If you have a Marine out there who's not up to snuff, listen to Kyle's story. Kyle did it. With the fucking herniated disc.
Suck it up.
What's your excuse? Yeah.
Big time hard fucking move. Fat bodies out there, disgusting.
Well, that's how that's what I was doing when I was injured. I was in charge of the fat PT.
You're doomed, dude. There's no shot you could.
You know, if I could go back and I could do it again, and you put me in a position like company gunny or company first sergeant or something like that, I would not call my fat bodies BCP or anything like that, the body composition platoon. I would call them my militia, because if you look at the militiamen all over the country now, the quote militiamen, they're all little chubby bunnies just going out there and playing Marines.
They all need a little help. They all need
I would call them my little militia. But sometimes whenever you're getting out, you need a spot to start because you had a plan to stay in the military for a long time. If you need to find a job and a new place to live, if you're transitioning out and you don't want to stay where you're at Yuma, Arizona, whenever you get out of the Marine Corps, if you don't want to stay at Fort Polk, Louisiana, when you get out of the Army, you can go to Indiana, because not only do they have some of the best housing prices in the country, but they also have amazing opportunities for the veterans there with 80,000 current job openings in Indiana. InVets.org is the digital connecting point for employers specifically looking for veterans. InVets works with employers from all different industries across the state of Indiana to create a second door and hiring process specifically for the veterans and military spouses. InVets veteran engagement team is standing by to work with you to help you find the right career in your transition. Indiana's communities constantly rank as some of the top places to live and raise a family. If you don't believe us, listen to Pat McAfee. That dude cannot shut up about Indiana. He fucking loves it.
I love it too. I fucking love it out there. For real.
Honestly, I thought about like if I was going to relocate for Barstool, I would probably go to Barstool Chicago. Like I would live in Chicago, and you can live in Chicago or work in Chicago and live in Northern Indiana, take a little quick train and be there in no time, have the housing prices in Indiana and work in Chicago. My friend, that's the best of both worlds.
Even though InVets is trying to get you to work in Indiana, that is the ad.
Oh, yeah. So you could do both of them. Well, if you have a spouse who's not a veteran, then they can work in Chicago while you're killing it with one of those 80,000 jobs in Indiana. Go to InVets.org/zero to create a profile and learn more about the Indiana communities. Browse the current job openings in those and receive your free t-shirt. I wore it this weekend. It was fantastic wearing that little shirt because it makes my biceps pop. I don't know if you guys have noticed. I'm looking pretty trim.
It's all the woodworking, man.
It is. No, like, really, I'm working out.
It is all the stuff you're doing. You're sweating a lot. You're working muscles you haven't been working in years, so it's definitely showing.
Well, I wasted my fucking time yesterday wearing my InVet shirt. I was out there sweating. It was like 95 degrees because we have a cold front that moved through last night. I was standing out there. I made this a little deck area for around our stock tank pool that was going to cover our like sand filter tank. It looked like absolute shit. It looked great whenever I built it on the ground. When I put it up there, it looked like trash. So I had to take it down. That is really, really depressing. Not as depressing as not having a job whenever you get out, though. So make sure you go to invets.org/ZBT /zero to create a profile and get that free t-shirt. Nothing like a good t-shirt. And for the Marines out there, go do that now because you can use that as a free skivvy shirt. It's the same color as our skivvy shirt. So you can wear it as a skivvy shirt, which it's always nice to have because you can never have too many skivvy shirts. All right, let's move on to what round are we on? Round four?
Round four. Chaps, if you're ever feeling yourself in the near future and you just are thinking, oh man, I'm wasting this good t-shirt and nobody sees me, just snap a photo, send it to us.
All right, I will. Next time I'm looking really good, I'll do that. Nothing says look good like whenever you're fresh out of Marine Corps boot camp. I think Kate's talked about that a lot because she is the slowest eater in the history of the world. And so in boot camp, you have about 5 minutes to eat. I would say 5-7 minutes top to eat your entire meal. With somebody like Kate that eats very slow, that was difficult and you lost a lot of weight, right, Kate?
Oh, yeah, ton of it.
Hey, so, I picture you coming out of boot camp looking like Sarah Connor, Terminator 2 style.
I went to a size zero. I was like a size, because of rugby and beer, I was like a size 9, and I left boot camp at a size zero.
Yeah, man.
You couldn't even go to 5'7"9. Too small to go to 5'7"9.
I was too small, and then I bulked up again immediately. But, you know.
Yeah, we've seen the picture. So you leave boot camp, you're feeling good about yourself. That's part of it. And every single one of Marines have this affinity for where they went to boot camp, whether it's Paris Island or Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego. You love where you went to boot camp. It's something that is really ingrained in you. Like I hear news about Paris Island, I'm paying attention because that's where I was, quote, born. Well, every Marine could have that feeling stripped away soon in order to fulfill a congressional mandate to have co-ed boot camp throughout the
Women
Marine Corps.
Women are ruining everything.
Yeah.
No. So
the Marine Corps, this is from Gina Haskins from military.com. The Marine Corps is considering a plan in which it would close 2 existing boot camp locations and funnel all recruits to new bases where men and women would train together. Marine entry level training is a long way off from being able to meet a congressional mandate to make its East and West Coast training both acceptable and support gender integrated training in the coming years, the Corps top general said on Thursday. That is the leading service to study the option of opening a third training base in a new location. I think that is something that affects, like, you think about all the different stories. Like, the Crucible really was amazing because you would talk about Medal of Honor recipients who were at the same stomping grounds. Being one of the first ones to go to the new place, be like, you're kind of robbed of that history. But I think it is a new freshness, like where you can train together, do everything together. And hopefully that changes some of the pervasive sexism, mm-hmm. essentially, that is predominant in the military in a lot of ways, not just the Marine Corps, but the military as a whole. Although the Commandant said that we're no way organized to do that right now, you have to know that different congressional leaders, if you're a congressional leader and you're in charge of Paris Island or you're in charge of San Diego, you do not want this to happen on your watch, right? Well,
some of my thinking was, well, also, if you're the town surrounding those bases, you don't want this to happen mm-hmm. for sure. Well, some of my
not
thinking
as
was
much San Diego, but definitely Paris Island, like Beaufort mm-hmm. and all that, all those places.
Women only go to Paris Island because there's simply not enough of us to make, even then, you know, there's four platoons of dudes, like four battalions of dudes going through while there's only one of women. And even then it's usually much smaller than each of the men's. And so of course they don't even have women at all on the West Coast, because there's just simply not enough of us to make it work. Part of my thinking is that has been the same for so long. Why don't you try harder to get more women in the Corps so that, I don't know. I feel like it's been the slowest growth for women of any branch, like beyond comparison. And I don't understand, like, I feel like we're Marines, we can figure anything out. And he's like, yeah, well, the buildings aren't set up right for it. So, oh man.
It's yeah, I was thinking about that too, Kate.
It's like, that you don't fucking want to, dude. It's that you don't want to, and you're dragging your feet.
Different. I think Berger is a little bit different from a lot of the other, because some of the comments that he's made, he very much wants the women ratio to increase in the Marine Corps. Like, he's made several comments about that. But you think, like, logistically, about what's going on.
Figure it the fuck out. They're like, the logistics are too tough. So that's
how,
like,
difficult could it possibly be to change urinals into regular toilets? Like,
but even that,
the logistical nightmare is like the housing area.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's the bathroom situation. But even that, like, okay,
change the toilets. Like, I'm not a genius plumber, but somebody
or
can
teach
figure
us
that out.
How, give us sheepies to pee standing up. Damn it.
But like, you could just change.
Can you imagine that though? 2020, we're making the female recruits pee standing up.
Yeah. Marines do it different.
Can't you just change the sign on the door though, and make a male bathroom female? And like, I get it, there's urinals in there, but there's still toilets in there too.
Yeah, so but not enough, dude. Like, if you're talking a platoon of say 80 during the summer is what how many you'd have in a platoon, and you do really like if you try to go even if you go. Let's say 60-40 is the ratio that you achieve. That's a lot, because a male head will have maybe 10 toilets, like regular toilets in there. And then, but they'll have like 40 urinals or something insane.
Yeah. Just the cost benefit analysis here. It just seems like it'd be a lot more efficient just to adapt Paris Island and San Diego than
Paris Island would be easy. Like, that would be easy.
They would both be easy. It's doable all around. It's been doable for decades now, and they don't want to do it, and they're dragging their feet on it because they don't want to fucking do it. It's that simple.
But what about?
I get annoyed about it because I feel like it is the root. It is where the very beginning. It is where the problem of the way women get treated in the Marine Corps starts. It's where it begins. It's where I know for a fact the male drill instructors put the little seeds in the heads of the recruits. Almost every male Marine I know has, oh yeah, we were told stories about X, Y, and Z. You guys were known as sluts and trash and mm-hmm. nothing and less
you
than
smell
us.
Smell that? Here comes the female Marine.
Before you even got to meet, that's where it's born. And we are the ones then who have to deal with it the rest of our fucking careers, our lives in the military, whatever, and on social media afterwards for decades to come. And so I don't understand why it's so hard for a bunch of high ranking officers to say, we've been given a mission, let's just fucking get it done, instead of coming up with
officers. It seems like it's a problem in appropriating funds for all the way up the chain of command in the Department of Defense.
I agree with you, but they should have figured it out a long time ago. And like, there was an article the other day about General Berger saying like, oh, it's still a long ways off. No, figure it the fuck out. You're the commandant of the Marine Corps. Figure it the fuck out. Like, with all due respect.
Now, what if Berger is on saying this now? Because have you been to Marine Corps San Diego lately? That place is fucking trash.
Like when
yeah, they're garbage. So it does make sense, instead of if we're going to revamp and redo everything, why not start from scratch? There's plenty of places in America where you can grab a huge swap. Indiana or West Texas, where there's nothing. Texas would probably give you the land if you said we need 10,000 acres for a Marine Corps recruit depot, and that's where we're going to be centralized, because Texas
you can't
is right
become
in the heart
a Marine
of the
until you rope a steer yourself.
Bring that. I mean, seriously, think about the different climates that are in West Texas that you would have. You have mountains, you have desert, you have high altitude, you have low altitude. You can establish everything in Texas. High heat, low heat, everything. Right here in, just in West Texas, and it would be cheap as fuck. Like, why not just bring it to West Texas? If you're going to build everything and redo everything, don't waste it on stupid old... Because you could... I mean, they can make the money back with that land that they own in San Diego from Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego. If you sold that in California, how much money you would get for that shit, and then just buy land here in Texas. They could probably buy half of Texas with that.
Yes, but the seagull community would be devastated. That we talked about the hawks that they're hiring there to get rid of the seagulls. I think it, yes, there are considerations that have to be taken. Yes, changes have to be made, but I do not buy for a second that this
it's
is
not
some
take
huge,
decades. I mean, let's
like, or even years, they should be able to figure it out pretty fucking quick. And so I think it's crazy,
especially the service that prides itself on the ability to improvise, adapt, and overcome.
Right. What are we
just
doing?
Do it. Just do it. Just say, and if it starts with the commandant, you're right, Kate, about that aspect. If the commandant said, listen, we are going to accomplish this, and we're going to accomplish it while I'm the commandant of the Marine Corps, make it the fuck happen. They're going to do it.
Yeah. Like, they'd work around it. Right.
They're
going to
do it.
Yeah.
Right.
So, all right, let's move on to round number five. This is Kate's interview. But before we get going there, I do want to make a mention that it's National Suicide Prevention Month. And I think that some of the things that we're going to talk about here, that Kate's going to talk about here in her interview, I think is incredibly poignant. We've got to be open and honest about real dialogue and how real change happens. You never get to the place where change happens by being a pussy about it. You can't do it. If you see the statistics of the gun-related violence, not just in America, but amongst veterans, you have to mention it. And it can't be something that you're scared of. You have to go at it full bore, just like we would after the enemy, full bore, straight to the heart of the issue. Let's talk about it. Let's be honest. If you have friends that you see are struggling, be honest about that with them. Say, do you have a gun in the house? Those type of things. Care about each other with the same passion and courage and care that we cared about our careers. Do that with each other. That's going to solve much more than, say, push-ups or t-shirts will. And I think that's going to be illustrated here in the interview. Let's give it a listen.
Joining us now on Zero Blog 30, special guest Chris Marvin. He is part of a 30-person veteran advisory council with Everytown, former Army officer who Black Hawk pilot, from what I heard.
Yeah, that's right. Really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. So quick background on your military. How long have you been out, and what was your kind of path through that?
I have to do math already. I got out in 2009, so it's been over a decade. And I was in a little bit less than 8 years, did ROTC in college. I actually have a joke about this. I have a really long military history in my family. My father was in Vietnam. Both my grandfathers were in World War II. My great grandfather was in World War I. I have a paternal line relative who fought in the Revolutionary War and a bunch in between. And besides my father, that had absolutely nothing to do with my choices to join the military. I just needed money for college, and I had an ROTC scholarship. And I really wanted to go to Notre Dame, which is where I went. And that all worked out for me. And ended up being a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, which ironically my father had been as well. So I accidentally followed in his footsteps, but yeah.
That's always the version that sounds. I'm always like, yeah, it was definitely 100% 9/11, and not that I drank too much beer in college and played rugby too much and got into too much trouble. It was that, you know. But yeah, no, long family military history, proud tradition of that. But so you flew Blackhawks, and where were you based out of?
So I was, after flight school, I was stationed in Hawaii. I took a role as a platoon leader in the 25th Infantry Division almost immediately. And within a year, we deployed to Afghanistan. So relatively early in Afghanistan, 2004, early 2004. first deployment out of Hawaii since Vietnam. So a lot of interesting sort of things, you know, related to the division and mobilizing the division. My deployment was cut short. Mm-hmm. I was home by, well, I wasn't, yeah, I guess I was on my way home by August. I was wounded pretty badly in a helicopter crash near the Afghan-Pakistan border, which, you know, I broke both of my legs and my arm and broke all the bones on one side of my face, did a lot of damage to my knees, my hips, my shoulders, and an unceremonious way to end my aviation career, with, you know, the one more takeoff than landing in my career.
Right.
But you know, it was, it took me a long time to kind of adjust to that. I was still in the military for a while after that, going through rehab and surgeries and therapy and whatnot, and then sort of figuring out I was eventually medically retired. And it took me years even beyond that to realize that that experience was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me because of kind of what I was able to make out of it. And the reason it took me so long is because there was one of my soldiers died in a helicopter crash. And it's really hard to sort of come to grips with the idea that, you know, when someone loses their life, that you know, it can turn into something good for me. But right. I then came to this realization that if I don't do that, right, if I don't make it one of the best things, then, you know, then what else, what am I doing for him? You know what I mean?
Right. How can you honor their life by, you
absolutely.
Know, by what you're doing?
Mine.
Right. Absolutely. So after that, you know, difficult, really probably very difficult few years, especially we've had veterans on who, you know, years in recovery and healing and all that. And then all of a sudden, and you're surrounded by this support network, all of a sudden you're out. And right. So you decided to stay in Hawaii. What was your path after that?
I took a break from Hawaii somewhat reluctantly. Mm-hmm. I am in Hawaii now. I was in Hawaii then. But after I was medically retired in January, I believe, by that fall, I moved to Philadelphia to start business school. So I found a place to transition that was a little bit less jarring, I think, than jumping right back into get a job and join the rat race and, you know, be part of corporate America or whatever comes with that. I went to business school, which trains you for corporate mm-hmm. America in both right and wrong ways, I think. but yeah, so I went to Philadelphia, ended up spending 7 years there. After business school, I took a job with a nonprofit, ended up launching a campaign called Got Your Six,
which worked with
Hollywood on the way that veterans are portrayed in film and television. And so that was, I guess that was the second step in me accidentally becoming a professional veteran, which I had no intention to do either.
I know what you mean. All of a sudden you look around and you're like, how did this happen? What?
Yeah. I didn't plan this, but you know, none of the best things are planned, but I'd previously worked and helped, I was one of the first employees of The Mission Continues when they were just a young startup.
I'm an alum.
So kind of, yeah. Oh, you are? I didn't know
that. I'm a Mission
that.
Continues alum, and that's kind of what led to my career today. I was volunteering with them, and then The Daily Show with Jon Stewart was doing the Veteran Immersion Program. I said, oh, put me in. And then I knew I wanted to be in showbiz somehow, some way, the rest of my life. And I kind of credit The Mission Continues with the path that my life has taken. So yeah, definitely very cool. So Got Your Six, The Mission Continues. And, yeah. I mean, you have a lot of programs that have changed a ton of veterans' lives and the perception of veterans too, which in roundabout ways has also changed our lives for the better. So you're doing all these things. What next? I didn't realize you were like such a renaissance man in the veteran space.
Not at all. Know. No, I just fall into these things. I mean, I'll you know, another one that I've been involved with since the beginning was Team Rubicon.
Yes.
Because The Mission Continues asked me to mentor this guy named Jake Wood, who was starting a new thing. And he was a Mission Continues fellow for a little bit. And I did such a good job as a mentor. He actually quit his fellowship because Team Rubicon was doing so well. So I don't think I did a great job there, but have been, you know, at least engaged with them for a while. You know, I left Got Your Six, is it 5 years ago now? 5 years ago now, and started my own consulting practice because I found that the veteran voice was really, really powerful. You mentioned veteran perceptions, right? And mm-hmm. that was really what I was working on first and foremost was how does society perceive veterans? And what you learn when you start to really study that and really to work in that area. And what we were doing was trying to shift the narrative about veterans from veterans being broken and needing, you know, charity and pity and having low expectations for them and trying to focus on the idea that veterans are actually leaders and civic assets that can benefit our communities, right? And so moving from that charity narrative to that empowerment narrative. And what you learn when you focus on that empowerment narrative is you learn how valuable and powerful the veteran voice can be. And I wanted to find ways that I could help employ the veteran voice in other social issues outside mm-hmm. of veterans issues. And so I've done some work in renewable energy with my consulting practice. I've done more work in Hollywood, have done work with national parks and public lands, have done works with documentaries as well, sort of outside Hollywood filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And my primary client right now and some of the work I'm most proud of is in gun violence prevention. I work for Everytown for Gun Safety as a consultant, and I lead their veteran strategy. And so what we're trying to do is say, where does the veteran voice play a role in the larger gun violence prevention movement, and how can we exploit and leverage that veteran voice in a positive way?
And I think that ties in so directly with, you know, you do so many things that work on people's perception of us and how ultimately that does affect our lives. And I think one of the biggest things that if you're not very familiar with the veteran community, one of the biggest things that stands out to people that they do see that sticks in their head is the 22 a day. That narrative has been pushed so hard, and the 22 push-ups challenge and all these different things that kind of feed into the, you know, it's a struggling group, it's a this, it's a that. And it's, I feel kind of torn talking about it sometimes. I don't quite know how to talk about it because there is truth to that, about 20 suicides per day for veterans. But at the same time, I see the push-ups thing and I see that and I'm like, good initiative. I don't know if that's the best judgment. I don't know if that's the best way for us. And so through your work with Everytown, you have coming up on September 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern, the role of guns in veteran suicide. I think we talk about, hey, let's just stop it and prevent it. But one of the conversations that I think probably because it's so difficult to have is how are these suicides happening? And right. 70%. Up to 70% involve a gun somehow. And when I read that stat this week, because new legislation, lawmakers have reached a deal this week to send sweeping veteran suicide prevention legislation to the White House. And in reading about that and seeing that there was no real serious discussion of gun safety in that, and reading the stats that 70% of these suicides involve a gun, I was sort of blown away by it. I like kind of couldn't believe it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to jump off of there. I'll start with this.
Yeah, let me jump. Here's 24 things I'm going to dump on you at once here. Now you sort it out and answer all those things.
I can, and I'll try. I just got to remind me what I forget. But the 70% or the, we say 7 in 10 often. I think if you want to get really technical, and I kind of like to with the data, this is the MBA coming back out in me, right? It's like 68.2%, right? Or 7 right. in 10 if you want to round up. Great. Compare that to the civilian population. So how many civilian suicides are by gun, and it's about half, right? So we're talking about a significant increase from 50 to 70% is a significant increase. Veterans are using guns more often. We know that guns have a much higher lethality rate when it comes to suicide, right? So something like 90 to 95% of suicide attempts by gun are going to go to completion, right? Are going to kill the person. Everything else combined is like you're talking about single digits, right? And so I did the math on this one. So this data might not be exactly right, but I think that it is outside of the veterans, you know, in the civilian world, only about 3, maybe up to 5% of suicide attempts are guns, right? The use is the lethal means attempted is a gun, mm-hmm. but it accounts for half of the suicides. Right. So you just see how much more effective they are. If effective right. is an okay word to use here, mm-hmm. they get that job done, that unfortunate and tragic job. What we talk about with veterans is that's a huge reason that veterans are 1.5 times more likely to die by suicide than civilians are, than non-veterans are, because they are using guns more often, because we're familiar with guns. We understand, we actually have been taught and trained on the lethality of guns. And if your intent is to end your own life, then, you know, many people, I think, will choose a way that's going to do it effectively again. I mean, you see veterans doing that, but which is why guns need to be a part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Similar to what you said about the legislation, the VA recently put out their Prevents Task Force report, and it was a presidential, you know, committee, and they formed a special task force, and it was through the VA, but other agencies were involved, and it was meant to, you know, it's the president's directive and how we're going to end veteran suicide, et cetera, and PREVENT stands for something that I haven't memorized, but it's a great acronym. And I'm sure that all our military listeners will appreciate a great acronym.
We need another one. We don't have enough.
Yeah. But what, if you look at that report, it was, I don't know, 60 or 70 pages long. And the only time that the word firearm appeared in the report was in a single recommendation, like in the back of the report.
Right.
And I think it appeared like five or six or maybe eight times under recommendation number 9, which was basically like, yeah, guns are a way that veterans sometimes, you know, it was just very pushed off to the side.
Right.
And this idea that, like, you know, we'll talk about that because we kind of have to. And what you realize is, aside from that little 3 or 4 page piece of that report, the rest of the report is effectively ignoring 7 out of 10 veteran suicides.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, you can try to do all the interventions you want to prevent veteran suicide. You can try the mental health. You can try the peer counseling. You know, you can try getting people to stop substance abuse if that's an issue. You can, you know, try building their families back up or their networks or get them a job, like all the things that might contribute to someone's mental state or emotional state that would lead to suicidal ideations. We want the time to try all of those things. What the gun does is it steals that time from us as a group, as a community, as a population that wants to end veteran suicide or reduce veteran suicide. The gun is faster than peer-to-peer support. The gun is faster than mental health counseling because the gun will kill in an instant and it'll kill effectively. And so, like, we know that because we're from the military, right? And we've done that, you know, in interpersonal gun interactions. But we have to talk about the gun first.
And that's one of the most startling things I read is you talk about from the time that a very serious ideation is had, they say within an hour, it takes about 60 minutes. If the person has a gun, they act on it much sooner than if they did not have a gun. And I was reading this and I was thinking, I've been open about it on the show, but when I first got out, I hit my own really difficult time in life where a lot of things just felt like they were falling apart. I felt like a failure and I convinced myself, I don't need to be here anymore. And it got to the point where I had kind of written out here's the plan, but thank God I didn't have a, I look back and I think because I was not thinking logically at that point in time, I was not thinking with reality. I was out of touch with reality. And I think, thank God, as dark as it sounds, that I did not have a gun. Because my plan involved going all the way up to, it would have taken forever. You know, my plan was very, very pain in the ass. It was a whole thing. But I think back on that, and I know it sounds crazy to say out loud, but I still think reading that, I go, thank God I didn't, in my darkest time when I wasn't thinking straight, that I couldn't just reach over, grab that and go. I read that and I understood what a huge part of this is about and why it's such a huge deal to ignore it.
Well, yeah. I think, first of all, I think it's amazing that you talk about it, right? And you talk about it publicly and other people can hear that, you know, you went as far as to write a plan. And a lot of people have taken, people talk about being suicidal as if it's like black and white, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, there's a spectrum, right? Like, you know, if you ask veterans, have you ever thought about what suicide might be like? Most people are like, yeah, it occurred to me. Like, when, you know, I'd stand at the edge of this bridge, would I jump? Nah, I'm not going to jump, you know, but like, you know, you get all the way to like, do I have a plan? Do I have a means? And means counseling is a very important intervention. And the first place to start with means counseling has to be guns. You know, veterans are more likely to own guns. You know, 45% of veterans own guns compared to 20% of non-veterans. So a lot, that's a significant amount of firepower amongst veterans. And this one surprised me because one of the things we talk about at Everytown is how veterans know how to properly secure our weapons. How do we store them securely and safely, especially, you know, around your family or whatnot. Apparently some of that knowledge that your drill instructor, you know, drilled into you is lost when you come and have your personally owned firearm, both for, I think, the military members and for veterans, because one in three veterans say that they have a unsecured loaded firearm in the house. And that's
just within arm's reach within 2 seconds.
Yeah, and so that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
That's what it is. And so one of the things we talk about from an intervention standpoint is, you know, you're going to own guns, that's fine, but store them securely, and store them separate from ammunition. And you talk to people who said, it was just too much of a pain in the butt to unlock my gun safe and then go down to the basement and get the ammunition and then put it together. So I thought about it and I talked to my wife and I didn't do it. Right. You hear those stories. Mm-hmm. A guy on our Veteran Advisory Council named Mike Washington, he goes by the nickname Top, Master Sergeant from the Marine Corps, amazing guy, lost his son in Afghanistan. His son is actually in 2-7 Marines, who is a unit that is notorious for the number of suicides that they've had, but he lost his son in combat, was despondent afterwards, and tells a story. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post last week, tells a story about standing at the on a bridge wanting to jump, right? Mm-hmm. After he'd been drinking and all these things, and then deciding, you know, kind of heard a voice from his son and decided this wasn't the way it was going to end. He walked off, he got the help he needed, et cetera. And he says point blank, like, if I'd had a gun, I wouldn't be here, because it was a lot quicker and easier than the bridge.
Right.
And means matters. And so I think that when we ignore guns as means, we're ignoring, again, 7 of 10 veteran suicides, and we're ignoring the problem altogether. And it's really tragic, quite frankly.
Like you said, and it is a difficult, I feel like as soon as you bring up the topic, people get up in arms about it. And it's a very difficult conversation to have. Well, we fought for this, these veterans fought for this country. How could you, are you talking about taking their guns and blah, blah, blah. And it gets heated very quickly. But two, just safe storage and limits. If you're having a difficult time, do you have people in your life who can maybe hold on to them for you, or to know to have you lock it up securely? Or these are conversations that should be had. It's not that we're going to come take your guns away. It's let's be smart about this. Then if you're having trouble, let's sit down and talk about this and figure something out. I feel like that's so sensical.
Well, a lot of, we make in gun violence prevention, we make a lot of comparisons to cars, right? And like the barrier that it takes to get to cars and the freedom that you're allowed to have a car, but this license. Look, this is a much cleaner and better analogy, because it's not about cars. It's about the buddy system that it has to do with cars. If you are a veteran who feels like you're in crisis or that you might be suicidal, find a buddy, a relative, a neighbor, a friend, whatever, and say, here's the keys to my gun safe. Mm-hmm. Just like you would say, I've had too much to drink. Here are the keys to my car. And just like I would say as the sober person, like, hey man, you've had too much to drink. Give me your keys. If I know my friend's in crisis, I'm going to say, you're in crisis. Do you have a gun in the house? You do? Okay, cool. Either give me your keys or let me program your guns. You don't have to give me your gun. Keep the gun in your possession. I get that. That's taking the gun out of your house takes away something from you. Let's restrict your access to it. And let's do it with someone who's a friend. It's what we kind of are talking about as a DIY ERPO. And that's two acronyms, which is awesome. The first one everybody knows, do it yourself. But the ERPO is Extreme Risk Protection Order, or red flag laws. And 17 states have these, where, you know, a spouse or a loved one or somebody can petition the law enforcement to come actually take guns from someone who might be a danger to themselves or others. Look, A, that's only in 17 states. B, a lot of people don't want to do it or aren't aware of it. It's much simpler and just as effective if you take the keys, just like you would take the keys to the car. And I think as veterans, that's sort of an accountability measure that we should all be really aware of and willing to take part in on either end, either as the person giving or taking the keys.
And I think knowing too, we talk about, well, what do you do if you can tell one of your veteran buddies or just anybody of your friends is struggling? And I think one of the things we're not taught is to say, like, hey, do you have a gun? Is to ask, hey, do you have one? And if so, can we talk about that for a minute? And here's why I want to talk about it. Like, I feel like that's something. And again, this legislation kind of ignoring that. Is that a result of, I don't even quite know how to ask it. Is that the influence of the gun lobby saying, don't go near this? Is that, why is it being ignored when it's 7 out of 10?
Yeah, well, it has to be the influence of the gun lobby and then the sort of the politics that's created. I mean, the NRA's agenda is all guns all the time, anywhere for anybody, right? Like, let's give, you know, 4-year-olds missile launchers kind of thing. Like, it's that dystopian. And so, like, there's no arguing with it. It's couched in the Second Amendment. But you know, we can absolutely find the middle ground to have these conversations without saying I need to take away your guns, right? Whether it's temporary or permanently, we can just say, let's just be responsible. You as a veteran, any veteran or any person who could find themselves in crisis and contemplate suicide can take the first step when they're more in their right mind, right? And more thinking clearly to store those guns safely, right? That's the first thing. And then to like, to also know to what, like you said, identify signs of crisis and then hear those calls for help. And then separate a gun. I've had an instance where a friend of a friend said that her spouse was potentially suicidal. And my first question, I mean, he's a veteran. My first question was, is there a gun in the house? Because mm-hmm. she felt helpless. She felt right. completely helpless. She saw the signs and she didn't know what to do. And it gave her some solace to say, you know, well, I know that if I can get the gun out of the house, that removes that, like that, you know, that hair trigger moment, right? Not to be literal, but like right. that may happen like this, and then gives more time to allow other interventions to do the right thing, right? Whether it's mental health counseling, whether it's, you know, peer to peer stuff that gives that space that we need, to walk that person back and get them in a good place.
Right. And even so, I was raised with guns. I knew how to shoot from the time I was a little kid, and you know, out in the backyard with the 22 and going upstate and shooting the cans. And I enjoy shooting guns, but at the same time, I would place the welfare of my fellow veterans hands down any day over the, you know, I just have a really difficult time seeing why this is not included in the legislation when it's clearly so, so incredibly clearly such a big issue with, and like you said, you're not coming to let's take all the guns away. There's just smart and simple things that we could start doing that should have been included here that weren't. So moving forward, again, on the 29th at 6 p.m. ET, you have the role of guns of veteran suicide. People can join on that and we'll put the info in the blog and go over that info. Great. But what would you like to see? What's the goal moving forward?
I mean, we talked about a lot of it. I mean, you led this by mentioning the 22 a day thing and the 22 push-ups viral challenge. And I think that it's really important that we actually are moving from we as a society community, veteran community for sure, if you want to do 22 push-ups a day, great. You should probably do more. It'll help strengthen your pecs. But if you want to do that for the challenge, great. Understand that you're just building awareness. Mm-hmm. And understand that there's a difference between commemoration, which is what that is, because you're past tense, right? The number of suicides that have happened, we're going to commemorate those, and prevention. Commemoration and prevention are very different things, right? And so I can't help but do this, but it's not 22 a day. That came out in a faulty 2012 report.
Right.
Then they revised it to 20, which you mm-hmm. mentioned. The actual number, that includes service members, active reserve and guard service members. So the actual number of veterans that die by suicide in a day is 16.8 on average.
16.8, okay.
Yeah, it's the reason I think we don't talk about that is because it's really hard to do 8/10 of a push-up unless you're in the Air Force.
Right.
Then that's all you do. But no, I mean, 16.8 is a real number. And then there's like 3-point-something is service members who are in guard reserve and active. 11 of those 16.8 are by gun, right? And so it's hard to figure out, like, what are we doing when we want to build awareness for false data, mm-hmm. right? Like, what does that even mean? And
right.
so I get that these people are good intentioned, but I'm also really concerned about the fact that we know that in certain cases, raising awareness for an issue like veteran suicide could actually not cause the numbers of, you know, veteran suicide rates to go down. It could actually cause them to go up.
Right.
Because it sometimes people feel like they're been given permission to because well someone else did it. 22
I'm just another one of the 22 a day. Right.
Again, if you look at a unit like 27 Marines, like you see that suicide spreads like a contagion sometimes.
Yeah.
And there's always other factors, right? It's not just that. There's always other factors, but that's something that we want to move away from. Is the awareness and the commemoration is fine. But not unless you're doing something for prevention, mm-hmm. right? Not unless you're actually talking about guns. You're talking about secure storage. You're talking about separating veterans from their guns when they're in crisis. And potentially, if you're into it, talking about legislation like red flag laws. Like that's where we have to get. And we see it happening at the state level. And we'd like to see more of it happening at the federal level. And you know, the truth is that the more responsible veterans can be about their own firearms, the less likely they personally are to die from suicide. A lot of times we at Everytown talk about what veterans bring to the gun conversation is some level of credibility and respect, but also the sort of the pillars of gun culture that we learned in the military, which are training, safety, and accountability.
Right.
So if we can think about our training, think about safe storage, and think about how we're accountable, not only to ourselves and what happens with our firearms, but to each other, then I think you're going to see, you can see a shift. We'd like to see a shift in cultural norms in the veteran community about how we talk about veteran suicide, and the first word should always be guns. The first seven words can be guns, and you can say three other words, because then that's 7 and 10. Mm-hmm. And we're properly covering all those veteran suicides by gun.
Well, I think that's hugely important. I feel like it's the elephant in the room of the veteran suicide conversation that, again, even I learned so much this week just reading about it. I was like, oh, whoa, I kind of never even really thought about it. I was part of that, 20 something a day, and like, oh man, and never really gave thought to like, how are we preventing this, and how is it happening? And I 7 out of 10 is clearly an issue. So I think it is important, this 30 veteran council, advisory council, like you said, it is important to have actual veterans, those who have been there. You're a Black Hawk pilot for an infantry unit in overseas, like you know these are veterans who know what they're talking about, and who also now have seen, I'm sure it's like the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but we all have lost friends to veteran suicide too. It's at this point in a sick way, that's the case. And thinking on it now, I'm like, and yes, it was a gun. And so I think this is something that we all need to talk more about, and that needs to be kind of a less pushed to the one line in the back of the legislation thing for sure. And I'm really grateful for your time. So again, what is this event on the 29th, and how can people find what you guys are doing?
So this is it's a virtual event, and it's something we've actually taken. It's an event we've been doing every 2 weeks, talking about the election through the lens of both veterans and gun sense. So mm-hmm. veterans for gun sense. And we've actually, this is the first one we're offering publicly. So previous to this, you had to be part of our little forum of about 100 veterans who kind of signed up for it, and had really interesting conversations with a bunch of members of Congress and some other distinguished guests. We're going to be joined by Representative Chrissy Houlihan, of Pennsylvania, who's an Air Force veteran. And then we're going to have a panel of three people who are both suicide experts and survivors, who will talk about gun suicide and veterans suicide. And if you guys want to put it in your media, that would be the best place to have it. But also, I'll be tweeting about the event and putting the RSVP on my Twitter, which is @ChrisMMarvin, if people need to try to find me there. Other than that, we don't publish a lot of the things that we're doing, but we're trying to build a larger movement of veterans, really through the hard work of all the volunteers cross country and Moms Demand Action, right? So we would tell veterans, if they really want to get involved with gun violence prevention, inclusive of veteran suicide prevention, find your local Moms Demand Action chapter. They are all over the country, and they're doing great things. And don't be afraid to put on a red shirt that says "Mom" on it, because I think that's the most veteran, or in a man's case, the most masculine thing you can do is walk around and say, "I'm doing this to prevent gun violence." So we encourage veterans to do that. We'd love to have more veterans raising their voices to save lives.
Absolutely. If you're a veteran interested in preventing veteran suicide, this is a great way to do it. Check them out. And again, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Look him up on Twitter. We'll have the info in the blog about this podcast, and you can find it all there. Chris Marvin, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's a tough subject. Anytime you mention guns in this country, it is a tough subject. We are talking about it in the ZBT group chat. I think guns right now are easily the most divisive topic that you could possibly discuss.
And, yeah, easily.
And he said it is difficult, because as soon as you mention it, people do get, for lack of a term, like up in arms. And it is a slippery, like, I get it. You propose this idea, and then somebody says, well, that means that could lead to this and this and this, and then our guns do get taken away and blah, blah, blah. But it's still, whatever conclusion come to, it's still worth having the conversation when 7 out of 10 suicides, military related suicides, are with a gun. I mean, the two that I know off the top of my head were guns, like the two people that I knew. Mm-hmm. And I had never really thought about the means in which they had committed suicide before, but that if it's that many, it's like, I just don't understand why it's not more part of the conversation in this legislation that's coming up. And I'm a broken record, because I said that like 50 times during the interview, but I think I grew up around guns. I was shooting them since I was like a little tiny kid. And one of the things that I was taught, both from my family members who taught me how to shoot and who got me really into it, and from the military, is safety and accountability. Mm-hmm. Why can't that continue afterwards with this conversation? Yeah, I don't know.
It's one thing that we stress all the time as leaders. Whenever you get to the NCO rank, whenever you're an officer, one of the main things, if a weapon is out, you focus on weapon safety. It is a big part of the culture, and it should be continuing a part of the culture. If you're struggling, you have a depression, maybe it's time to put it away. Lock it up. Don't have it out. Do different. Be proactive in your own self-care. And I think that that is a big, big push that we need to make. And, you know, I get tagged on Instagram, and I'm not saying that these things are bad. I understand that it is definitely the heart is in the right place when we're doing all these push-up challenges. If you're not aware that there's an epidemic or a pandemic of sorts with veteran suicide, you're not paying attention. You don't need push-ups to know that that's going on. There's articles about it constantly every single week about what's going on. The change has got to happen in the heart of the veterans, because oftentimes we know that the ones who are left and our right are incredibly prideful and saying that I'm observing you struggling. You put yourself in that position of getting that text message, but so what? Have a little moral courage and reach out to those people. And if you are struggling, man, we love you. We care about you. There is people, even though that darkness that's inside your brain at times is telling you, no, that's not the case. People care about you. There is somebody to your left or to your right that has and will care about you. Don't let those demons speak to you in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chaps, I think you make a good point there too. You talk about people that have an affinity or have, you know, enjoy, you know, weapons and shooting them. And I think that's a fine hobby to have. But if you find yourself having those problems, just like you wouldn't add a backpack of 80 pounds to go run a marathon fast, you know, why make something harder for yourself than it has to be? So yeah, it's okay if you need to remove that one thing from your life, maybe find a replacement.
And dude, let me just say, if one of my good pals that I'm still friends with from my time in the Marine Corps, if they came over to my house today and they knocked on my door and they're like, hey dude, I'm real struggling right now. Do you mind taking my weapon for a week or two? I need to go get some help. I need to talk to somebody. My level of respect for somebody doing that would be through the roof. I would not look down on them at all. That to me, that I would be blown away by the courage that would take.
Yeah, it's not about taking guns or anything. It's just about cultural change within the veteran community, where if you need to temporarily turn over the keys or make sure, you know what, I need to make this a little more difficult to reach right now, or I need a friend to take care of it for me for a little bit. Just being open to having these conversations, because it is such a sticky subject with people. It's really tough. But when 7 out of 10 are dying in this manner, in a way where it's so quick that you don't have time to stop them and they don't have time to stop themselves, it takes away that time between the ideation and the action so much faster than other means that it's a serious conversation, something to think about. Even if you love guns and you enjoy shooting them, I do. And so I think Kyle does too. I think, you know, so I think it's still just something important to talk about.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to round number 6. Round number 6. This one is one of my favorite stories that we've had in a while, because there, as I've talked about on the show a bunch, I love The West Wing is my favorite show ever. I love it. And one of my favorite characters on The West Wing is Mrs. Landingham. Mrs. Landingham serves as the presidential executive aide, where she is essentially like his secretary, but she does so much more. She's the executive assistant, where she schedules this meeting, keeps everything on time, puts a pin in his jacket. He doesn't even realize that she does the small things like that, and has been with him since he was a congressman. There are stories like that that pop up in the White House that I think are incredible. We've talked about the chef that has been there for multiple presidents. This one is a little bit different. This woman's name is Lillian Brown, and she got her start in television in 1953 when she volunteered to produce an education program for the public school system in Arlington, Virginia. Knowing nothing about the medium, she produced a series on the churches of the presidents and the other Virginia mansions. She was also a weekly educational host for children called Do You Wonder? But that's not why we're talking about her on ZBT. The reason why we're talking about her on ZBT is because she served and was the makeup artist for 9 U.S. presidents. 9. That is unbelievable. Her first story in politics, it comes from the former Speaker of the House named Sam Rayburn, who is a Democrat from Texas. She said, "Mr. Sam, if you'll let me powder your nose, I will not relieve you of your manhood," Brown recalled in speeches that he gave years later. Once he recovered, he said, "Well, you just go ahead." Because think about that. In the 1950s or 1960s, how little a man would want to be seen in public wearing makeup. It wasn't something that they did, right, Kate?
Definitely not. But I think, too, remember they talk about, who was it, the Kennedy and Nixon, or who did Kennedy go up against in that debate on TV? It was Nixon, right?
Nixon, yeah.
And Nixon just looked sweaty and gross on the TV. I bet he didn't have makeup on. I bet you Kennedy did. So back then, it talks about this woman,
Well,
Ms. Brown.
We're going to talk about that. This comes up in the article where she actually, she mentions that, and it's just, it's so great because the president, while she was working for the president, was the day that she was called to the White House because Nixon was going to resign the presidency as a result of the White House scandal. She said whenever he got up to, when she got to the White House, she met with President Nixon, and he had obviously been crying. Because if you work your entire career, even though you did the shady shit that Nixon did, being the first president to resign under national disgrace and something like that has got to weigh very heavily on you. And she said, "We have to get you ready." And she ended up telling him a joke that kind of cheered him up and allowed him to get out of that kind of crying mode where he could understand the weight of what he had to do. And we needed to have peaceful transfer power from Nixon over to then President Ford. It's just incredible, the stories that we had. I would love to sit down with her.
Yeah, absolutely. Love and she just looks like such a lovely person too. But you're right. That story popped in my mind because back then, like, I feel like especially with appearances and stuff like that, I don't think men realize they also that TV just changes you. TV makes you look very different. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's very harsh, especially because you're under lights that you're not normally under. And so that she was starting to observe it from the other shows. Because we talk about Weird Life Past and everything. You said she had that child show, Do You Wonder? And then that show was produced by CBS News's Face the Nation. So she was doing this kid show for CBS that also did this big deal show. And the producers of Face the Nation noticed her guests, including men, were wearing makeup that she was putting on them. And so that's how she ended up, next thing you know, because of her children's show and putting makeup on people there, she's years later working for presidents and doing that for them. So you never know with what you're doing with your job, if you're doing it to the best of your ability, where it will take you. And that's my favorite part of this whole story.
And that she wasn't a trained cosmetologist.
No,
like, that's not what she did at all.
Right.
It says in the article that her tools included just a small sponge, powder puffs, Kleenex tissue. She applied a thin layer of liquid foundation followed by powder to soften wrinkles or diminish the circles under someone's eyes. She used a concealer. Besides, from every president, from Dwight fucking Eisenhower to Bill Clinton, mm-hmm, and most of the first ladies, Mrs. Brown applied makeup to countless other political figures. Think about knowing, meeting, and talking intimately to the point where you can put makeup on somebody with the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt, Reverend Martin Luther King, newscasters like Connie Chung, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, Diane Sawyer, and Leslie Stahl, amongst others, and all the presidents, and surely all the different leaders of state and all those people that have came to the White House. I think it's an amazing story. I would love to read her memoir. When she said that about President Nixon, I want to make sure that I actually get it right. She said he was weeping. She said in a 2010 oral history with the National Press Club, he was sobbing. And I thought, I've got 30 minutes to get this man ready to resign the presidency. The president's tears called Mrs. Brown's makeup to streak, and nothing she said could lighten his mood. She said, and I remembered the day that he and I got locked in a bathroom with a dog. Once when the White House Christmas tree was being decorated, the president's dog, King Timahoe kept bumping into a tree, knocking off the ornaments. Mrs. Brown took the dog by its collar and walked it toward the bathroom. Somehow she, Nixon, and King Timahoe ended up in a bathroom together as a secret service agent closed and locked the door from the outside. When she reminded Nixon of the story, he began to laugh, and Mrs. Brown was able to apply the makeup minutes before he sat down to announce his resignation to the country. That is unreal. And her final line, She said many political figures were Mrs. Brown's private clients, including former Texas Governor Ann Richards. Mrs. Brown picked out the turquoise dress Richards wore for the keynote address at the 1988 Democratic National Convention, where she said of George H.W. Bush, "Poor George, he can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth."
Ah.
What a lady.
I might put on makeup today. I might go the extra mile.
Do it with a Kleenex and a little powder ball.
I got fresh bangs. I might do a little Kleenex and a powder ball. But yeah, and it said she paid attention to every little detail in the set. She would straighten a jacket, rearrange the flowers, you know, do the same little things that you were talking about at the beginning of the show that really do make a difference, especially in the public eye. So very cool. Putting all the effort in leads to some pretty cool stuff. Pretty good reminder of that for sure.
No doubt about it. Let's move on to save rounds and alibis. Kyle, we'll start with you.
You guys want to hear a little more about Digby from last
year? Yes, the Umbrella Man.
All right. So we know Digby had a successful life after Market Garden.
So let me reset just in case you missed Friday's show.
Yeah.
Digby is, we're referring to a British officer who was known for carrying an umbrella because he would constantly forget the safe passageways whenever he was coming back into friendly territory after going to fight the enemy in World War II. At one point, he stuck his umbrella through a German vehicle, poked the operator in the eye, and incapacitated him there. And he did many other things. But Digby is a legend. If you want to hear more about him before Kyle starts telling more about him, go back and listen to Friday's show because I absolutely love Digby. Big Digby guy, even though he has an umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Big Digby guy here. So he was captured.
Big Digby energy.
Big Digby energy. That's kind of hard to say. Anyways, he was captured during Market Garden at the Arnhem Bridge. It didn't work out for him there, but because of his injuries, he was sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital. But what did he do? He escaped out of a window on the second floor. With his second in command, Captain Tony Frank. I also like how they never mention his rank. It's just Digby. Like, if you have an umbrella, you don't need rank. You have an umbrella instead.
Mm-hmm.
And well, if it's also a weapon. So he escapes. They made a compass out of a button on his uniform so he could navigate to a town called Merindal in the wherever he was, where he found a Dutch woman who put her in contact with the Dutch underground. He got some papers from the Dutch underground saying he was Peter Jensen, a deaf mute son of a lawyer, so that he didn't have to speak and didn't have to listen to anyone.
Dude, that's the second time we had this story. Do you remember the World War II pilot who was captured and put into a German prisoner of war camp that I interviewed?
Yeah.
He said the same thing. Whenever he crashed over France, the Dutch underground actually helped him, and they told him there must have been hundreds of deaf mute people walking around at that
point. Just a ton of deaf dudes running around the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
So long story short, he gets in touch with the Dutch underground. The Germans don't recognize him, even though one time he helped push a Nazi car out of a ditch and all the German soldiers were around. He gathered up 150 escaped soldiers, led them to the front lines, where he signaled a V for victory sign using Morse code with his torch, which is the British word for flashlight or moonbeam. Mm-hmm. And members of 30 Corps ferried them across the river. And he made it back. What a badass.
Dude, they need to make a movie about it. How is there no movie about this
guy?
Yeah,
I mean, he was in
where's that Digby movie?
He was in The Longest Bridge, or what is it? Yeah, The Longest Bridge, I think, where it was the big movie back in like the 50s or 60s about Operation Market Garden.
Oh, I'll never watch a movie from the 50s. You can guarantee that.
Well, you probably should, pal. It's a good one. I think John Wayne's in it, too. He was in everything, though.
That's neat, Digby, crushing it.
Yeah, so a little Digby update. I think that's it on Digby, but I felt like his story didn't need to end on Friday. It's a really cool story.
Oh, that's awesome. Kate?
I got nothing. Boring as per usual.
There we go. I don't have much either, but I do want to mention that we're going to sound the retreat in a little bit, but at the end of it, I want to put in an interview that Kate and I did last week on Thursday with a gentleman named Alan McDonald. Alan McDonald, if you've watched the Netflix show about the Space Shuttle Challenger, this interview is incredible. The way that he recounts some of the things that happened the day that the Challenger actually exploded, and how the scientists and the engineers kind of predicted what was going to go on. The way that he goes in, I know this is a super long show, but you're going to enjoy this interview. We had several people, including Kate's dad, reach out to us and said enthralling interview of how to, I wish that we could sit down with Alan McDonald for much longer. He is an incredible man with an incredible story. And he was one of the first people to be, he's the reason why the Whistleblower Act was established in 1986. So I think you're going to enjoy that after the retreat. Other than that, I don't have much. Take care of each other. Love each other. Appreciate each other. Reach out to a buddy that was to your left or to your right this week. Tell them that you care about them. It'll mean the world. It's on the retreat.
Been a top, top, top show right now. It was just recently released is the docuseries chronicling the buildup and aftermath of the devastating Space Shuttle Challenger disaster on January 28th, 1986. And it basically, it's a four-part series that chronicles, you know, the new Space Shuttle program and how it captivated America and how they were looking for a diverse, determined crop of astronauts. Then, you know, they choose teacher Krista McAuliffe to be the first civilian on the shuttle. And that was such an exciting thing. Like it really did captivate the nation. And then, as we all know, there was a major malfunction all board, and it follows what happens in the aftermath of that. So now on the show, we have Alan McDonald, aerospace consultant, lecturer, and author. He was the director of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motor Project at the time of the Challenger accident, and he led the redesign of the solid rocket motors as VP of Engineering for Space Operations. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, really appreciate it. How has it been for you since this came out? Have things been picking up and getting a lot busier for you on the lecture side since this series came out?
Yes, I received quite a few emails and several texts on my cell phone about it.
Oh, I believe.
And they were all positive, basically.
And so what was your role at the time? You were the director of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motor Program, Motor Project, when this happened. And then you led the redesign. So can you explain for people in a more chaps and Kate kind of way, what were you doing at this time? And then what happened in your life afterwards? How did your job change?
Well, at the time, I was the director of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motor Project for my company, Morton Thiokol, that built the solid rocket boosters that are used for putting the shuttle into space. And I was at the Kennedy Space Center supporting that launch. And as being in the position I had, I was responsible relative to resolving any problems that may occur in preparation of that launch, and had the responsibility for approving a launch decision or not. And what happened was the Challenger had experienced a couple of delays, both of which certainly could have been avoided. The first one was, frankly, a bad weather forecast that expected to have rain in the launch window, and that really never happened till late the afternoon, so we missed a perfectly good chance to launch it that day, which was a Sunday morning. And then the next day, Monday, when they attempted to launch, there were getting ready in the launch count. And one of the last things they do is they close the crew cabin door and they remove the handle by rotating it about 90 degrees and pulling the handle off because it's a protuberance for them for reentry. And for some reason, the handle stuck and it had a bad thread or something. They couldn't get it off. And so they called for some technicians to bring up a huge suitcase of battery-operated tools and halted the count for a while and tried to remove it, but they couldn't remove it because the battery-operated tools didn't have any charged batteries. They're all dead.
Oh,
wow.
So they had to go back and eventually brought this what I call high aerotech aerospace tech tool called a hacksaw, and they literally cut the handle off the door, a fairly thick aluminum bar. And you don't do that in a few seconds. It right. took a considerable amount of time to do that, and then they went back into the count. Meanwhile, they'd used up most of the launch window in trying to fix this problem. And as a result of pushing it out to the end of the launch window, there was a front coming toward the Cape. And that front had some very strong winds out of, in front of it. And as a result, it exceeded the ability of the shuttle to be able to return to the launch site if it had to, and it had, they had to scrub the launch that day. And I remember going to my friend's house in Titusville, who was the vice president of our space operations at Kennedy. He actually built up the shuttle in the vehicle assembly building. And shortly after I got there, I received a telephone call from a fellow that worked for me by the name of Bob Ebling, and said that they were just notified that some meteorologist in Orlando was saying that, gee, behind these strong winds that canceled today's launch, there's extreme cold front headed to the Cape, and that it may be as cold as 18 degrees Fahrenheit by tomorrow morning. And I immediately said, good grief, Bob, I'm really concerned whether these O-ring seals we have in these big fuel joints will operate properly at those kind of temperatures. And he said, well, we are too. And he said, what I need you to do is find out from NASA what is the expected forecast temperature at the launch pad hour by hour, not in Orlando, so that we can predict what the actual temperature will be on various parts of our hardware at the opening of the launch window. And I said, fine, I will get that information, which I did. And I said, when you receive that information, I want you to bring all the engineering people together and have them use that along with any information they have, and for you to be prepared to present at a conference that I will set up this evening on what we understand and what our concerns are. But at the end of that conference, we have to make a recommendation whether to launch or not and in what condition. And I expect the Vice President of Engineering to make a recommendation, what is the lowest temperature that is safe to launch. And I set up that meeting, and the engineers did exactly what I asked them to do. In fact, most of the charts were handwritten mm-hmm. and faxed down to the Cape, and to the engineering people at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And as a result of their presenting that information, the Vice President of Engineering got on and said, based on the information presented here this evening by my engineers, we would not recommend launching below 53 degrees Fahrenheit.
Good boy.
Now, the way they arrived at that number was that it so happened that just 1 year earlier, January 1985, we launched a shuttle, and we retrieved these boosters under parachute out in the ocean and bring them back and pull them apart and eventually send them back to Utah where we make them to be, reload them with propellant for a future use. And what we noticed when we pulled them apart, that one of these big fuel joints where these things are connected in each side, a booster on each side, showed evidence of some hot gas getting past the primary O-ring and stopped by the second. Now, this is such a critical function that you have to have redundancy, meaning there had to be two O-rings in this area to make sure that the gas could not get out. And this was the first time we'd ever seen gas get past the first one. Fortunately, stopped by the second one, but it penetrated almost all the way around the joint. And I remember getting prepared for the launch subsequent to that of trying to explain why it was okay to continue flying the shuttle. And what we had concluded was that that was the coldest launch we'd ever achieved at that time in the shuttle program. And that was 53 degrees is what we, the O-ring temperature was. And that the next launch wasn't going to be until April. And everybody felt comfortable that we'd be well above that, which we were. Well, it so happened that now we're facing a situation where it's going to be much colder than that, that we never expected. And so that the recommendation that was made, I felt, was absolutely correct based on what we had.
And for somebody that's from Florida, if you're listening, 18 degrees in Cape Canaveral is just unimaginable to me. I grew up in Florida my entire life, and I don't think I experienced more than 10 days in 20 years that were below 30.
Right. And anything below even 53 is cold. And so you're saying the temperature 53 degrees or below, because temperature, you know, makes things expand or shrink. So what, it was the cold was kind of making these O-rings not fit correctly?
Well, what it did is that these O-rings are a fluorocarbon type rubber material. They're 12 feet in diameter, about a quarter of an inch thick. And any rubber material, as you decrease the temperature in it, one, it becomes harder and less flexible. And secondly, a very important element of an O-ring is it's compressed in a joint, which means it's squeezed in there and it's pushed together, and you have to be able to expand it back out when these joints pressurize because it opens a bit. And it doesn't want to go back to its original condition, which maintains contact seal on both sides. It's kind of like taking a wet sponge and putting your thumb on it and then gradually releasing it. The sponge will follow your thumb, but if you take that sponge and throw it in the freezer, then take it out and push on it, you'll notice it has a dent in it. It'll stay that dent until it heats up. Well, this is somewhat similar to what was happening that we were concerned about, is that these O-rings lose this resiliency property, its ability to spring back to its original condition the colder it gets. And that we were concerned about this cold temperature because we never expected to see it that cold. In fact, I remember the flight readiness review after the experience we had in 1985, that one of the charts I had was out of the Orlando Sentinel, which said that that launch was preceded by the three coldest nights in history of Florida, where it got in the teens for three straight nights in a row before it finally warmed up in the afternoon when we launched that one. And I said, we're never, and that was out of 130 years of recorded history. I said, we're never going to see that condition ever again down here. Well, all of a sudden we saw one much worse. And so the recommendation appeared to be logical, but I was shocked at the NASA management people that was with me there of challenging the basis for that recommendation. They felt that we didn't present any hard test data that said the joints wouldn't work properly at the expected temperatures, which was true. We didn't present any hard engineering analysis that said that that joint wouldn't operate properly at the expected temperatures, which was also true. And these are the premier type of information you have to support a launch, but not, in my opinion, to stop one. All we had was what they claimed was a, quote, qualitative observation, which was also true, of a photograph showing this first O-ring got burned a bit and leaked gas past it, but stopped by the second. And they didn't feel that was adequate data to restrict the shuttle to such high temperature launches. And I was rather amazed that they challenged that. I thought it was a slam dunk. They said, yeah, let's just wait another day. But they didn't. So they finally asked my boss back in the plant, a fellow by the name of Joe Kilminster, Vice President of Space Programs, what his opinion was. And he said he'd have to support the Vice President of Engineering's opinion that we shouldn't launch below 53. And Mr. Malloy from NASA said, well, he feels that that data is totally inconclusive because we also showed that we got a little bit of soot past an O-ring on one flight that fall at 75 degrees, and therefore you can't conclude temperature has anything to do with this problem. And I remember Mr. Roger Beaujolais, who was our chief seal expert at the plant, saying, you need to look at those photographs. The photograph with the one at 75 degrees shows a little bit of light gray soot in one area that didn't hardly go around any place other than where it went in. He said the one that was at 53 was very dark black, soot, very thick, and it went almost all the way around the joint. He says, my professional opinion is what you're seeing there is the influence of temperature. When you look at these huge solid rocket boosters, they're 12 feet in diameter and 140-some feet long. He said the stack-up tolerances and all these metal parts, O-ring thicknesses, the grease we put in there, the grooves that they go in, when you look at the range of pieces of hardwood that could come together to make one of those joints, I believe what we're seeing here is the influence of temperature. And I fully agreed with that.
And I think that it's fascinating that the way that you're laying it out, that the scientists are giving essentially people who are put there by political positions in part, because that's the foundation of the Netflix show Space Force, is they have these engineers that are telling Michael, or they're telling the main character, the general, what should actually happen. And he knows that his bosses are watching. And I could see that portrayed here. And the Challenger as well, because you know, with schools and all across America getting ready to watch it, they wanted this to go off without a hitch, even though the scientists are saying there should definitely be a hitch. We shouldn't go right now.
Oh, yeah. And there was a lot of pressure there because of the teacher on there and the number of people watching to get the launch off. And so what eventually happened was the fellow from NASA, namely Larry Malloy, asked my boss. He said, he told him, I think your data is inconclusive. And he said, you sure that you've looked at this critically enough to really understand whether it's safe or not to launch at expected temperatures? My boss basically said that he wanted to go offline on a caucus to make sure we had all the data that we could present and to reassess the position we had. He did that, and so this three-way conference we're on, he went offline. And while they were offline, I told the NASA folks that, you know, I don't understand why they're concerned about this, because to my knowledge, the rocket boosters are supposed to be qualified to fly from 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 90, and even though that's below the 53, we aren't even get there, and therefore they can't even accept a launch recommendation outside the specifications.
And Mr. McDonald, we're kind of running out of time just a little bit, but I wanted to mention one fact of your bio that I find to be incredibly interesting, because you did pass this information along to your boss, and he passed it on to the director of NASA. Then you eventually got put back in your position by an act of Congress. And for those listening, he's the only person in the history of the United States that was put back in his position by an act of Congress. What was that process like for you?
Well, that was very strange and very difficult, because I did get removed from my job, because after the accident, I walked down on the floor of a presidential commission's hearing and told them what they just heard from NASA about how the launch decision was made was not really true. Mm-hmm. Here's what really happened. And they were so shocked by that, that the chairman of the commission said, you know, if what you said is true, this will be in litigation for years to come. Mm. And he was right. It was. But as soon as I got back to the plant, my management removed me from my job and gave me basically a non-job, head of scheduling or something, hoping that I would quit. Hmm. And I seriously thought about it. But during the interim time, the commission called in the NASA management folks and the Sokolov people that reduced my job and read them the Riot Act, because they found out I was really absolutely true about what happened and the warning that was given about it. And as a result, Congress followed those hearings and passed a resolution to reinstate me to my job.
Wow.
Because they found out Thiokol had set me aside. And that's how I got back into my job and was given the job of fixing the problem, becoming the head of the redesign.
And soon thereafter, in 1989, is when the Federal Whistleblower Act was established, and partly because of what you did. That was whistleblowing. This is not correct. If we're going to be scientists, let's look at this scientifically. Would you agree?
Yes, I agree, because they did not have one in 1986 at that time. They said they had one to protect, I think, federal employees relative to whistleblowers, but not people from corporations outside the government.
And you have also, just really quickly before we go, if you want to look up Alan MacDonald's book, Truth, Lies, and O-Rings, Inside the Space Shuttle Challenger Disaster with Dr. James Hansen. So he, you published this book through the University Press of Florida. And so you can look that up. Truth, Lies, and O-Rings. It goes into the whole story. And I mean, it is a really difficult thing. And for you to have to have watched that happen and experience it. Thank you for speaking out and for telling the story and for joining us on the show today. I'm sure that's not always an easy thing to think about.
No, but it was such a national disaster and received so much attention, probably as it should, that it never goes away. And the only good thing was that we were able to solve the problem and make it safe for those afterwards, but that launch never should have went up in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Thank you, Mr. MacDonald, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for asking me to be on your program.
Yes, thank absolutely. You. And you can watch on Netflix. It's pretty much one of the top shows right now, but it's The Challenger, The Final Flight.